Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Hello, I'm so excited for today's episode. I am co-hosting today with a special colleague, Mark Gilbreth. He is going to jump in and do his intro momentarily. So for Mark's listeners, I am Jamie Russo. I am the host of the Everything Coworking podcast. And behind that, I am the executive director of the Global Workspace Association and the founder of Everything Coworking and the founder of a coworking space in Palo Alto, California called Enerspace. So Mark and I are going to have a conversation today about the state of the industry. We're going to, of course, talk a little bit about our upcoming Global Workspace Association conference. Mark, I'm going to turn it over to you so that you can introduce yourself as well.
Hey, Jamie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, this is the Flexible Office Economy, and I'm Mark Gilbreth, your host. And I'm equally thrilled to be sitting here with Jamie. Great to be with you, my friend. And for Jamie's audience that hasn't met me before, I'm the founder and skipper of liquidspace.com. And I also have the distinct pleasure of serving Jamie as the current president of the board of the Global Workspace Association. And for anyone not initiated to the GWA, it's a long-standing, in fact, the largest industry association, uniquely focused on serving the many different constituents of the flexible office economy. And as Jamie touched on, we're excited about the upcoming annual conference, which is happening in Washington, D.C. from September 18th to 20th. So great to be with you, Jamie, and great to meet your audience as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. This is exciting. I don't think either of us have done this format yet. So Mark has an excellent podcast. He mentioned the Flexible Economy podcast. You can find that on the new Apple Podcasts or Podbean. And he had some excellent interviews already in his repertoire. So definitely check those out. And yes, our upcoming conference. So I don't get to see Mark in person very often, but looking forward to that in September. We are deep into prep calls for the panels this week. So I am wildly excited. We have a topic on management agreements on Friday. We've got a couple, one of your guests will be on a panel on corporate occupiers, Jacob Bates. You've interviewed him. We have...
There's a who's who list of...
Yes, totally.
You just touched on Jacob Bates, who's the CEO of Common Grounds. We've got Lisa Picard, the CEO of EQ Office. We've got Dan Tangerlini, the former head of the GSA, which is, hey folks, the world's largest commercial office portfolio is our own federal government. And Dan led that apparatus. Who else do we have coming?
Nick Agarwal from Knotel is on the corporate occupier panel. Emily Watkins, who leads JLL's kind of corporate occupier practice, is hosting that panel. We have Bond Collectives, the lead of their design team, is joining our design panel. Who else? We have our keynote speaker is from the Ritz-Carlton, so big theme around hospitality, which is, you know, critical to our industry. So yeah, Greg Fuller will do some opening remarks for us. He is the chairman of NAOP, the Developer Association, and also I think the COO of Granite Properties, and he's done management agreements with local operators. I'm sure we'll think of some more as we get into our conversation.
Yeah, so on stage and at the conference, there will be a gathering of a pretty diverse tribe. Under this tent of the GWA, we'll have some of the leading names in co-working, leading names in serviced office. We'll have some of the biggest, in fact, the biggest building owner in the world. We'll have occupiers. For example, Dan from the formerly of the GSA that had the largest portfolio in his hand. And then a rich array of additional sort of specialty service providers that are part of the overall apparatus of the flexible office economy. So put it on your calendar, folks, or reach out to either Jamie or I for more information about how you can get connected to the GWA and even attend in DC in a few short weeks.
Mark,
who gets the first question?
I know. Well, I think I'm going to pose the first question to you. So, you know, so I've known you for... I was trying to think of when we met, probably 2012-ish, through Lexi, the League of Extraordinary Coworking Spaces.
I remember where it was. It was standing in line in Austin, Texas, in the sun at the Juicy Conference, waiting to get food during a break. And you were standing behind me, and I remember thinking, damn, she looks fit. And I later learned that you certainly are. But yeah, I think it was 2012.
Okay, good memory. Yes, lots of good industry events with lots of good memories and serendipitous interactions. Like that's, you know, exactly one. And then later we got connected through Lexi, and certainly now the GWA, you've been a board member for a number of years and instrumental in our growth there. So one of the reasons I always love to get a chance to talk with you, whether it's in person or sneaking some time after a GWA call, is just your unique perspective on the industry. I think as operators, we can be a little bit myopic. We're focused on, you know, our business, but you're one of those folks that's like really out and about, and you see a lot of what's evolving in the industry, who the new players are, where the trends are going. You see so much. And so I just wanted to kind of talk to you about your view over the liquid space life cycle of the evolution of the industry. You know, we went from not that long ago to like people thinking this is still a fad to, you know, we have institutional building owners creating their own brands. I mean, we've just come a long way. So can you just talk about kind of from your perspective, what you've seen and what that looks like, and maybe a little bit about, you know, where we're going next?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is undeniable that dimensions of what we would call the flexible office economy are exploding and growing ever more diverse. When I founded Liquid Space 9 years ago, we were inspired by the opportunity to bring technology to, and at the time, flexible office economy that was mostly defined by service office operators like Regus and the hundreds of others that identified as such. Co-working at that time certainly existed. It was 4 or 5 years into its early development, but the number of operators were in the tens to hundreds, not the thousands that we now see. Now, 8 years on, I can somewhat confidently look at what has transpired and identify what I think are three distinct phases. You know, phase one was really initiated 25 plus years ago by the early innovators in serviced office. At the time, there wasn't even a term for it necessarily, but today we look back on it as serviced office or business centers or executive suites. And players like Regus and Stratus and HQ were the big names that really paved the way. Co-working, which sort of first came into existence in San Francisco in roughly 2006, is now a well-defined term. And I think that emergence of co-working, which was largely defined by new attention around community and the human experience in the space, as well as kind of a revolution in the actual design aspects, a move toward more open plan, more of a communal experience, is the second definitive sort of generation of flexible office. And with that second generation, which I think carries through to this day, we've seen the scale of supply, if you will, more than double. But I now believe quite strongly that we are in the early stages of a definitive third stage, and one where the rate of growth is exploding further still. And I think that this third phase is distinguished by the entrance of a distinct new type of participant, and that's the landlord. We're going to have Lisa Picard from EQ Office on stage at the conference next month, and she's going to talk about how she now views participating directly in the relationship with the occupier in delivering, you know, fun, fast, and flexible space experiences mission critical to her firm. And EQ is not alone in seeing the existential threat, or said another way, the mission critical strategy of becoming a direct participant in the flexible office economy. What does that mean? Well, that means firms like Tishman and Brookfield and EQ and Swig and Boston Properties are standing up their own solution sets. In some cases, they're doing that in partnership with great flexible office operators like Industrious. In other cases, they're creating their own spec suite offerings or even creating their own co-working brands. And with that, I think there's a very formidable new participant. And a lot of the projections that firms like JLL and others have made about how much of the real estate economy will become flexible. And by the way, those forecasts point to north of 20% of all office. I think it's quite conceivable that landlords themselves are going to be a major portion of that.
A real driver. of yeah. that. Yep. I mean, I remember seeing that number and thinking that's wild. And could that be possible? And I think that's the interesting thing about your viewpoint is you're really kind of getting under the hood and seeing how they're thinking. And is this moving faster than even you thought it would? Or did you always think we'd get there?
We started reaching out to Liquid Space started reaching out to landlords several years ago because we well understood that they had historically lived with substantial amounts of structural vacancy in their portfolios. They would write off the remainders and the poorly positioned pieces and the hard to lease spaces. And that was oftentimes 10 or 15% of a portfolio. And so, you know, we were thinking opportunistically at the time, hey, could our platform and could customers who want flexibility be a way to actually, you know, make some money out of that idle inventory? And that was where it started. And we found receptivity amongst owners for that. And so as early as 3 years ago, we began to sort of evangelize that notion that, hey, landlords are going to be a force. Now, we were at the time, it was us evangelizing because we were both trying to convince occupiers that, hey, there was a possibility to go do a flexible term deal with a landlord. And we were also trying to inspire landlords to give some attention to that. And that moved relatively slow because landlords were conditioned to work in a certain way and with certain channels and with certain legal structures. But now it has started to accelerate. In some ways, it took longer than I thought. The acceleration that's happening now, though, I think is a function of owners recognizing that it's more than the structural vacancy play. That, like, that was intriguing, but not mission critical. Because landlords were profitable, even with their structural vacancy. What's flipped, we see, is that owners are now seeing flexible office as a principal asset strategy. Not to be 100% of their building, but it's now a principal strategy alongside traditional leasing. And the more progressive and smarter and more active owners are saying, oh, I need to do both. And now they're actively working on how do I do flexible office? Will I do it with a partnership with Industrious? Will I do it or Common Desk? Or will I do it myself? Will it be spec suites or will it be full service hospitality enriched co-working? But they're actively into the how now. And so now it's moving faster than I might have expected, although that kick or that inflection took a little bit longer than I wanted it to, I would say.
And what do you think about the speed on the corporate occupier side? Because I think that's the other piece, you know, even non-landlord providers, you know, larger co-working space providers hoping to see that demand come down the pipeline and feeling like that has taken a while. And we'll get some of that from Emily Watkins at the conference. But what's your perspective on sort of the pace of that shift? Because to your point, with the landlords being used to working a certain way, corporate real estate also used to working a certain way. How is that changing?
Yeah, I mean, big organizations have inertia and change happens slowly with a bigger organization. So whether it's a large institutional building owner with 100 million square feet of real estate, a ship of state that large changes strategy slowly. It's just unavoidable. Likewise, a big enterprise that has an apparatus and a way of doing things will change direction more slowly. As such, in the flexible office economy, the radical innovation, the accelerated learnings and experimentation happened with innovative, small, local co-working operators trying new things because they could. And likewise, the early innovation in terms of adoption of co-working and some of these new models happened with startups and freelancers. But now it is absolutely infiltrating the larger organizations. And I, you know, a couple months ago, I interviewed Robert Teed, the VP of Real Estate and Workplace at ServiceNow, a $5 billion enterprise. And he shared in that podcast discussion his expectation, in fact, his desire that flexible office would become 40%+ of his portfolio, where it's single digit today. And he went on to share that the only thing holding him back from rising to those levels was the availability.
Yeah. Yep.
So is every enterprise talking so boldly as that? No. But I would be shocked. If you were to analyze and get full disclosure from the Fortune 500, I'd be shocked if there wasn't a flexible office component of 99% of those firms. And there are now more and more vocal and referenceable stories from larger enterprises who are boldly leaning into that. In addition, from those earlier adopter startups that were some of the early users of the co-working experience, you now have some midlife companies that are scaling. You look at a firm like Automattic, that, you know, created WordPress. You know, they're now 1,000+ employees and they are 100% distributed. And when they have real estate, it's flexible in nature. So the stories are starting to be told, and the large enterprises are shifting in strategy. And I think the quickening is upon us. I think the acceleration of the industry is upon us, which is why I believe we're into a higher growth rate overall for the flexible office.
Exciting times.
Well, let me turn it back to you now, Jamie. The data, like if we look at the number of sort of self-declared flexible office operators today, you know, a number north of 10,000 globally. And even if we just look at like self-declared co-working operators, more and more operators are opening year over year. We've had compounded growth rate of 40 plus percent for 10 years on. I just interviewed the CEO of Office in India with 63 locations. In the Indian market, in the last 18 months alone, they've grown to over 350 operators, and 80% of the total count now didn't exist 2 years ago. So it would seem that barrier to entry for new operators is still quite low, or at the very least, a lot of operators are throwing their ring into the game. Jamie, you're deeply involved in counseling and coaching and consulting with a great many hundreds of emerging operators. I'm curious about your point of view on the game. And is the bar, as big operators are emerging, the Industriouses and the Common Grounds and the like, is the bar rising up yet? Is it still just as viable for a young local operator to jump into the game? Or is the game getting a bit more sophisticated?
I think yes and yes. I think we're at an interesting sort of phase of the life cycle of our industry. I mean, you talked earlier about sort of phase one, phase two, phase three, and in the second phase you referenced of co-working, we're roughly like 10 to 12 years in. And to your point, the beginning of that was, I remember seeing, was it Citizen Space in San Francisco? Yeah. That place, like the front door was a loading dock, no windows, some IKEA furniture. So that was, the genesis of the industry. And today you've got folks like Common Grounds who we continue to reference. And I think one of the reasons they're so interesting is because, they opened a couple of locations. I had the, sort of network to raise a considerable amount of money quickly. They're expanding very quickly. And then their, C-suite has these relationships to go after the corporate occupier. And so they're just growing really, really quickly. And they have an in-house design team. You move in, their in-house design team will help you design your office if you'd like. Beautiful, amenities, aesthetic, coffee bar. They've got restaurants in some of their locations. So you've got, not all of a sudden, but 12 years into this, you've got those types of locations with, considerable resources to fund that growth. Those are still somewhat, fewer and far between. And I think we're at a time where you've got folks who have access to capital or are proving out some unit models and some concepts and hunting for capital. And all of a sudden the capital market's starting to be interested in what's happening here, but lots of independent folks. I wish I'd pulled the exact stats, but at last year's conference, Instant Office and Scott Homa from Jones Lang LaSalle presented some data on the industry, and roughly 80% of the market is still independent operators. So, one location, two locations. So I think what I'm seeing is certainly there are the major players, the WeWorks, the Industrious, and of course the flavors of all of those are also blending a lot, right? It's hard to sort of say it's one co-working. We've got a Knotel that's, maybe more flexible office, but might be thought of as co-working. So, Bond Collective, a number of those brands that are growing, regionally and starting to expand into other markets. But then we still have this amazing influx of new independent folks that are starting new spaces. And I think sort of the fun piece of the opportunity that's been created out of the new way to look at commercial real estate is that, there are people that are not served by, the big players. Maybe they live in a geography that's not covered by them because they're 30 miles outside of Minneapolis, or they're serving, a portion of humanity that the larger folks are not going at. And I have a couple of examples. So I have a program called the Coworking Startup School. So I help folks who want to start and run successful coworking spaces. And I get a lot of independent operators. And the new cohort, we just had our first phone call yesterday in our get to know each other call. And we have a woman outside of Minneapolis who's starting a space adjacent to her CrossFit gym. And her story is like, look, this is my family. And this has been my community for 6 years. And every day when we leave the gym, we talk about how great it would be if we could just hang out and work together. So it's a commuter community. A lot of folks will commute into Minneapolis or St. Paul. There's no co-working space there yet. So she's going to start her co-working space adjacent to the CrossFit, and she's got her built-in community. We have a disabled vet in Miami who is super passionate about creating opportunities for vets, and that's an underserved population. And, you know, he just talked about how, you know, they really think of themselves as a tribe and get vets and want to support each other. And he wants to place make for them. You know, he wants to create that place where they can come together. And he pointed out that, you know, WeWork has made some outreach in terms of supporting that community, but at a different level, right? So another couple in Houston who are really passionate about going into underserved communities and helping them get access to sort of the social services and healthcare needs, they were talking about how it's hard to find a place for them to be because the communities that they're trying to get into don't even have, you know, good real estate. So, you know, I have a passion for seeing those types of opportunities come out of this sort of burgeoning industry and sort of on the periphery of what the WeWorks and Industriouses have created. I still think there's a lot of opportunity, but to your point, these businesses have to be designed to be profitable, to serve a specific customer, and to be sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, in 2006, when the Hattery emerged in San Francisco, there was no playbook.
Yep.
There were no technology vendors uniquely for
working
space. There was no operational playbook. There were no models or templates to reference in terms of business model or marketing strategy. It was all had to be invented by the entrepreneurs that hung their asses out there and gone the risk. And, you know, the inspired entities. 10, 15 years on, there are playbooks. You know, there's the playbook inside of those breakout firms that are scaling, you know, the Regises, the WeWorks, the Industriouses, the Common Grounds, Office Evolutions, the Serendipity Labs. In addition, there are tool vendors and other service providers who are now able to be specialists in this realm because there's enough of a market now to actually be an arms dealer or sell pickaxes to those miners. It's, you know, they're not going, their specialized tools are there. And so a tremendous amount has happened to sort of de-risk going and creating a, you know, a co-working space or a flexible office. Specialized furniture has been developed to be a part of that.
Right.
So the stuff that was risky in the past has been de-risked. I'm curious for your perspective about some of the franchisers, because, you know, today, if I want to open a co-working space or a flexible office, I can choose to just cobble it together myself, or I could turn to an entity like Office Evolution, which is a franchiser, or Serendipity Labs, which is
Etrex. Yep.
Regis now, I think, is moving pretty aggressively toward trying to drive the, essentially the sale of its playbook in a franchise model. So to an audience that you talk to a lot that's thinking, that's maybe inspired and wants to join the flexible office economy, do you have a point of view on the merits of go it alone versus de-risk it by being an Office Evolution operator or a Serendipity Lab or the like? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could go either way. I think the franchise model is an absolutely fantastic opportunity for anybody who wants to be an entrepreneur, but to your point is wants to de-risk and doesn't have that need to develop their own brand and serve a really niche market. So most of the franchise brands are generic, for lack of a better term, in sort of serving certainly a very heterogeneous membership. But yeah, we don't yet have, I don't think, a female focused, you know, franchise brand or someone who's focused on filmmakers or any of these other niches. So I think certainly if you're looking for that playbook and to be a part of a business that is really hospitality focused and makes you a real authentic part of the community, perfect. I think it's also a neat opportunity for the folks that have this passion that's been kind of burning somewhere, and it's an outlet for them to kind of create something that they've been looking to create. And I can't resist the plug for the, you know, associations like the GWA are there to help support the independent folks who are trying to support and connect, right? Because that's the other piece, is you can connect with folks And this industry, I'm sure you'll agree with this, it's wild how willing to share folks are. Even at the higher levels, I was on the prep call for the management agreement panel at the conference. So we've got Convene, we've got Industrious, we've got Car Properties. And those guys, the things they were talking about on that call, I'm like furiously scribbling notes and, you know, they were just kind of getting into it. And they're going to talk about that stuff on stage. And it's just like such a sharing, giving group of people. And so you can learn from others if you connect yourselves with the right folks.
Yeah. I hope this industry can hold on to some of that communal willingness to share, that idealism. I hope that remains a hallmark of it, because you're right, it is a distinct aspect of the GWA community and all of the firms that make it up.
Okay, Mark, let's go back to, I'm just gonna switch back and ask you a question. Sure. So certainly timely news. We have WeWork publishing their IPO documentation and lots of kind of viewpoints on the perception of the industry and the business model. We have Knotel, who we keep mentioning. They're on a panel at the conference. Can't wait to hear Vic talk about their future plans. They've just received a big new round of funding. What do you think the impact of this and some of the documentation will have on the perception of the industry?
Well, I think WeWork's S-1 filing, which is been out there for a week or so now, if nothing else, it's going to consume a lot more digital ink. WeWork itself hadn't already, over the last 18 to 36 months, consumed a tremendous amount of the headlines. Without weighing into whether or not WeWork is a good business, and there's certainly a tremendous amount of detail that far, far smarter people than I are extracting out of the S-1, and smart questions are being asked, I'll ask a more general one. It's like, all right, is WeWork an asteroid or an alien? And they're one or the other. Right. And, if they're an asteroid, are they this asteroid that hits the planet and wipes out all the old dinosaurs? And they're just this catalyst that was a cataclysmic event after which a new flora and fauna emerged. Like, are they just the thing that's going to break the old model, kill the dinosaurs? Right. The dinosaurs being those old ways of doing real estate. Or are they an alien race? And I don't mean that negatively. By that, I mean, are they some new master race that has landed on our planet with technology that didn't exist before, and they build the new pyramids, right? Because they brought a science and an advanced knowledge base that we just didn't have before, and they are going to be the new master race to populate the Earth. I tend to think, more than tend, I think they are more the asteroid than the alien. I don't think they are the new master race that is going to define the new consciousness of work and control it all. I just don't think they have that. I don't think their competitive moat is so deep as that. To their great credit, I think they've been an incredibly important asteroid event, because in their unique way, with the ability that they had to capture the imagination of investors and capture the imagination of occupiers, and they've done both those things, they've had an enormous effect. They have indeed helped accelerate the wiping out of a lot of dinosaur thinking. There's no large enterprise today that isn't at least contemplating what the benefits might be of flexibility. There's no broker today that isn't considering what the implications might be of flexibility to his or her traditional transactional real estate business. There's no building owner today that isn't considering the question of, is WeWork a threat or a customer or both? And those questions being asked are accelerating the emergence of new flora and fauna. It's breaking up the old model. So I think asteroids can be a good thing. I think they're more asteroid than alien.
I love that metaphor. And the asteroid metaphor, they have changed everything. And I mean, really back to our conversation about the pace from earlier, right? How much longer might it have taken without sort of that asteroid hitting and just really disrupting the way people think and forcing people to really question and look at things differently? Yeah.
It's exciting to see the news just this morning, in fact, of Knotel. Congratulations, Vic Agrawal and Amal and the team at Knotel. They just announced a $400 million raise and are now the second unicorn after WeWork that is of the new generation of flexible office operators. So to me, that's more evidence that there's not a monopolistic grip on the flexible office economy for any one operator. And there's growing excitement and zeal to see more entities stand up. So more change to come. And I also think that that open question of just how big of a portion of the pie will the landlords carve out is yet to be seen. it may not emerge and be the dominant play, but I think that's the wild card in the mix if we look out over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, and I think, I mean, kind of talking about the non-WeWork operators and what does life look like for them, I think this is kind of the new phase of figuring out, you mentioned earlier, the, you know, the Lisa Picard and other institutional owners that are either creating their own brands or partnering with operators. And I think sort of the, you know, the yellow brick road is how do I get to that point where I'm considered for those management agreements? I think one of the big challenges of the model is the lease arbitrage aspect, right? You know, as we've seen in some of the WeWork, you know, S1 filings and the responses from folks like John Arenas at Serendipity Labs and Justin Stewart and Industrious, who have said, well, that's not our model. You know, please make sure, you know, you're looking at how we do things differently. And, you know, but those are few and far between. The folks that can apply for those RFPs that are being put out, you know, already have scale and, you know, proven unit models behind them. So how do other folks kind of get to that point?
I think there's that question, like, as WeWork has had to now be transparent with their S1 filing, and people are digesting what the unit economics and the contribution margin look like. And they're looking at the risk of $47 billion, I think, of lease obligations and not yet profitable in terms of cash flows. If we zoom out for a moment and look at other industries and other sort of maturation pathways and as industries evolve, and look to see whether there's any model that might foretell where flexible office is headed, I'm pretty intrigued by the notion that where we may be heading is a further step beyond the flexible office economy as defined by Serendipity Labs, Knotel, Industrious, WeWork, Regus. And that's a model that you hear talked about as direct to consumer. So let's look elsewhere into our domestic lives. I buy my mattress from Casper.
Right.
I buy it online and they ship it in a box. And
now you drive by the mattress store and you think, why? Why?
Absolutely.
Why did that ever exist? Yeah.
I buy my glasses from Warby Parker and I go online and there's an extraordinary digital experience direct to, you know, Warby is selling directly to me. Casper is selling directly to me. And both those firms want to and do have a personal relationship, a brand relationship with me directly. I didn't buy it from a store, but it doesn't end there. 23andMe, I want to know about my DNA, right? Apple, my computer, I bought it directly from Apple. They're a unique flavor in that they've chosen to have their own retail fronts as well, but I have stuff online. So the hallmark of direct to consumer is a vendor that wants to have or feels it's existentially vital to have a relationship directly with the customer, Furthermore, they're going to sell directly to that customer and leverage modern technology, the internet, e-commerce as a way to do that. But there's an intent. I need to sell directly to Jamie, and there's a means, which is I have a web store. The reason real estate worked the way it did in the past, the reason transactional brokers existed, was that for a customer that needed space, there wasn't a store to go to online, and there weren't vendors that were interested in selling the space directly. And so these extremely important processes of discovering space and getting access to it and evaluating it and negotiating legal agreements and designing and fitting them out, all of those things were incredibly reliant upon specialists and experts. But what if Lisa Picard at EQ Office opens up an e-store and says, I want to have a relationship directly with you, Jamie, and here are all my wares, and here, personalize your frames with a few clicks, and let's go ahead and execute the agreement. Here, it's transparent. Let's go forward. I have a hard time seeing why that type of simplified process isn't going to be a part, perhaps a very big part, of how this ultimately settles out. So I think D2C is perhaps an eventuality that we ought to be thinking about more. Got a vested interest in that, of course. But I think we're on a slope where that's just where things are probably headed. And that raises interesting new questions, I think.
It does. I have one that I want to poke at a little bit, which is the asset owners, it's not generally in their capabilities to go D2C. So What's happening there? If they don't, so they could partner, which is what we see happening now, or they'll try to develop that expertise in-house. Right. What do you see that looking like?
Yeah, well, for the building owner, if we sort of stick with the D2C Casper or Away Luggage or Warby Parker sunglasses around. In the not too distant past, it wasn't unusual at all for building owners to sell product that was a raw concrete shell.
Right. Bought one of those. Yeah.
And so it wasn't unusual for a landlord to sell an unfinished raw space and leave it to the customer to go figure out everything. It wasn't unusual for the landlord to sell that in a 10-year commitment. It also wasn't unusual for the occupier to spend a tremendous amount of money up front to design and fit out. And then for both parties to scrape it all out at the end of that 10-year lease. So for an owner like Hines or EQ or Swig in San Francisco to move in the direction of D2C, two things have to happen. One, they have to have a product that is consumer. And so how do they do that? We'll answer that in a second. And the second is they need to have the means to sell D2C. Right? And so but what are the mechanisms? What are the business models? What digital tools they need to do that? On the first piece, like, can a landlord create a consumer product? What is the product? It's a ready-to-use office space.
Don't make me get my own electrical put in.
It's not a concrete box. It means a space that's got lights and power and a network and furniture, and it's ready to use. Does that require bending the laws of physics to figure out, or is that readily doable? Well, landlords are demonstrating that that's doable. And they're, in some cases, they're partnering with architecture firms or partnering with serviced office operators or co-working operators to get that learning. You know, EQ partnered with Industrious to create, you know, offerings at their Playa Del Mar, you know, spaces in Los Angeles. And so existing flexible office operators are helping landlords get smart on that. So there's lots of sources, I think, for how to create the consumer product, the product itself. And then how do I sell it, right? Do I sell it through traditional brokerage channels with that model on traditional leasing, or can the how I sell it piece be transformed? And I think, you know, that's where we play. Like, I think the how I sell it, yes, can be transformed. You know, leases are evil.
They're broken. They're painful for everyone.
In a direct-to-consumer transactional experience, the customer is not expecting to negotiate the price of the mattress. They're not expecting to argue over the business terms of the sunglasses. And I think there's the opportunity, it's already been demonstrated by firms, to bring fair and balanced and standardized terms to it. And so, if we did that, well, we don't need the attorneys for every transaction, and we don't need brokers on both sides having to help the customer demystify the fight between the two attorneys. That goes away. And then the transactional piece, you know, could you create an e-store for real estate? Yeah, they exist. Right? So that's being addressed. So an owner that wants to play has to figure out the product to sell, and then they got to figure out how to sell it. Both those things are starting to happen.
And in terms of operating and providing the hospitality and the community aspect, how do you think they're thinking about that as a function in their building? I mean, even that piece. Last year we had Equium at the conference, who that's their core business model, is helping landlords connect the people in their building. Yeah. So that's starting to happen a little bit more. How do you see that sort of shift evolving? Because a little bit of what I, just for my audience, selfishly, I hear you talk about things happening at a level that I suspect are more on the, you know, 3,000 square feet plus.
Right.
And then, so what about the more higher level serviced aspects of that and the sort of building as an ecosystem concept?
Yeah. So I think it's not so simple as a traditional lease or flexible office. I actually think that there are some important gradients or layers of what is flexible office. If I'm a landlord, for example, or an occupier for that matter. So at the very least, I think there are three distinct flavors of an asset strategy that you can contemplate. There's traditional leasing, where it's going to be invariably a longer term commitment on the part of the user of the space, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And the task of turning the physical real estate into a product that they can use is going to still be with the occupier. I'm going to hire an architect, you know, I'm going to buy furniture, I'm going to hire a technology partner to fit out the space. That, for the foreseeable future and perhaps ever, will remain the way that headquarters are created and where long-term footprints play. So that's one. And that may well always be the majority of a building. That majority might be 90%, might be 50%. At the opposite extreme, flavor two, and this is a flexible office flavor, is that full hospitality experience. Like, it's staffed, it's turnkey, right? It's a hosted experience, right? And so when, as a customer, you walk into that environment, everything is attended to. You know, up to and including possibly the spa water and the beer on tap. But the printer and the network and the security and the cleaning, it's all facilitated. And that was pioneered by players like Regis and others. And Industrious and Common Desk and Serendipity Labs and others are providing all their own unique, distinct flavors of a full hospitality hosted experience. The layer in between, and I think it's an important distinction, is what might be a standalone space that is ready to use. It's full turnkey. It's furnished. It has a network, but it has its own door. I mean, metaphorically and literally. And there's one team that lives in that space. It's a tenancy, but it's being delivered to the customer with two distinctions. It's fully ready to use. And secondly, it's on flexible terms. And what is that? Well, that might be a 6-month contract with Accenture for a consulting team that has a project of that duration, or it might be a 1 or a 2 or a 3 year contract with ServiceNow for a regional sales office that may renew, but isn't going to commit to a longer term than that because it's growing so rapidly. That intermediate layer, that furnished spec suite on flexible terms, I think is one of the bigger looming opportunities for building owners, because it doesn't bring that complexity of staffing and the delivery of hospitality with a human face. But there's still enormous value to that. And so the most evolved buildings that we see out there are doing all three of those things. People like EQ are doing all three of those things. People like SWIG are doing all three of those things. My view.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And I think we'll, of course, continue to see that evolve, but that model is logical.
Jamie, back to your comment, you know, on the periphery of the bigger brands, right? You know, on the bigger flexible office brands, what are some of the most exciting things that you are seeing of late in terms of, you know, differentiated flavors that are serving, you know, distinct audiences? Because the office evolutions, the serendipities, the industriouses, they're serving big audiences and pies, but the world is complex and there's lots of flavors of, there are lots of communities to serve. What has excited you most of late in terms of what you've seen out there on the, I'll call it the periphery as you've used the term?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are, I mentioned a few of the more unique examples, but I think it's really, it almost surprises me how many people will go into an existing flexible option and just not find what's right for them. And so just this opportunity to create different flavor, I'm amazed by the number of female focused spaces that are popping up. I would say almost half of each of my cohorts are doing female focused spaces. I mean, we've got the Wing and the Riveter and some other folks making some big news.
I can't help but to ask on that point.
I thought I saw that coming.
But is that, like, do you think to any extent that reaction amongst entrepreneurial females, is it at all being accelerated by these controversial times that we live in terms of the current political apparatus and even the woke sort of moment of the last couple of years?
I think so. I mean, I think that's helping bring it to a head.
I'd like to think it was, but I can't know. I'm sitting here.
I do. I mean, I think that's helping to bring it to the forefront, and then the ability to create places for these, you know, for a niche like females to come together, I think is a big piece of it. I do think probably it's, you know, there are gender differences in how people work and think about work and struggle with balance and families and career goals. And I think it's often the case that women just feel more comfortable working through those things with other women. So, you know, that's not my hat, but I can see why that would be the case. I also see spaces with a woman in my program who, she opened a space called Haven in Connecticut near Darien, and she is female focused, but has male members. Right. So that I kind of love in this sort of climate that we're in.
Follow on question, Jamie, as you reflect on like extraordinary sort of volume of consultative strategy that you've shared with your podcast, I think 160 episodes, and the conversations that you have with clients that hire you to help them solve problems, like what are emerging operators most in need of in terms of playbooks or tools or solutions to better ensure their success? Like in this, I'm sort of asking that from the vantage point of what signal should we send to the solution community? Like, where are the opportunities still to help would-be flexible office operators be more successful? Are there any glaring holes? Or where would you, if not, where would you like to see existing tools get better?
Well, I think it's typically, in my experience, a real fundamental business model question of, because of the sort of time in our industry where we have brands like WeWork. So, you know, I have a space in Palo Alto, and I noticed in the last probably 6 months, the search term is no longer co-working. It is WeWork. So WeWork has become the Kleenex, right? And that may be another brand in different markets where they're maybe not quite so present, but WeWork has become the Kleenex. And so when you're in a competitive market, knowing, you know, how are you different? Who are you serving? And setting up everything around your business model to reflect that. Because you are in a competitive situation, a competitive landscape, and you have to attract those folks that are looking for something different. And the Regis's play a part in that, and the Spaces and all the other, you know, global brands. So I think the fundamental question, which is, I think, partly why I love the niche, the folks that really are super clear on who they're going to serve, because the more specific you are, the easier it will be to attract the folks that are looking for you. I think outside of that, if you're creating a space that is more generic, for a lack of a better term, it's a flexible workspace, high on hospitality amenities, et cetera, then, you know, it's the playbook of sort of any business owner. It's systems, technology, processes, leadership systems, you know, the things that it takes to create a successful, sustainable business, which is not easy. I mean, we see that, right? You know, X percent of half of all small businesses fail. Capitalization. I mean, we talked about that a little bit earlier. This is not the easiest economic model to run because it is lease arbitrage. And so you have to have enough starting capital to fill up your space, to get through, you know, to cover your startup costs and get through that, you know, sort of fill your space phase and be able to thrive after that. And if you don't have that in place, which I think is one of the common reasons small businesses fail, then none of the rest of it, you know, matters. So I think both things, which I think is why I'm, you know, really interested in the sort of the landlord piece and how they're going to serve communities, because I think there's a good match meant to happen, you know, with operators who really want to serve and landlords that have the assets.
One of the other constituencies that has, I think, awoken in recent quarters, even but certainly the last year or two, is the traditional service provider community. Scott Homa of JLL, who publishes fabulous market analysis reports on flexible office, now a member of GWA Advisory Board. Avison Young, recently hired a head of flexible office solutions. Cushman Wakefield is or has done the same. Ben Munn, formerly of Instant Offices and Regis before that, and CBRE before that, has recently joined JLL as the head of flexible space. CBRE with their HANA offerings. So there's a lot of noise coming out of the traditional service provider world around this realm of flexible office. What does that signal to you? And are your customers, who tend to be these unique and smaller local uppers, are they being impacted beneficially yet by this service provider awakening? Or I guess just in general, what do you see coming as the brokers wake up, so to speak?
I think it's a little bit TBD, because I think we haven't seen it in play quite yet to know how do they deliver, right? I think they're solving a business problem that they have in their model to some extent and leveraging a market opportunity. So, but can they create those capabilities to authentically deliver a product that fits into the marketplace? So I think we'll still see some shakeout across the board. Independents who don't get the model right and don't have enough demand, to the bigger folks who have the resources but maybe don't quite deliver, you know, into a hole that the market is looking for. So I think it's still yet to be seen.
Yeah. So yet another reason for anybody interested in this topic to be at the GWA conference, isn't it?
I know. We cannot. It's my favorite time of the year. I mean, I can't wait. And I think you brought this up at the beginning. It is such a unique opportunity for all of these folks. We've talked about a lot of different constituencies today who are playing in this field and come together and to kind of talk about things. And one of our moderators was creating a little bit of tension. He's like, good panels have tension. And so I think there'll be a little of that happening, you know, at the conference, because there are a lot of different interests and viewpoints and folks trying to sort of, you know, create their place in this new world.
So you and I represent on this call sort of three entities, the Global Workspace Association, Liquid Space on my end, and your firm on your end. Shall we leave our audiences with sort of some direct directions on how they can get in touch, should they wish to, on any of those three fronts?
Let's do that. The Global Workspace Association is the globalworkspace.org, and lots of links to our conferences and all of our other resources, contact info, feel free to reach out. And then you can find in Mark's audience, then I'm at the Everything Coworking podcast, also everywhere that you find your podcasts.
Super. And on my end, if you found this conversation interesting, or if you're intrigued about the flexible office economy on whole, you can find the Flexible Office Economy podcast on Podbean or on iTunes. And if you're intrigued about the way Liquid Space, a technology company, is supporting the flexible office economy, and that includes tools and solutions for building owners and co-working spaces and serviced offices, as well as occupiers, large and small of space, you can find us at liquidspace.com. And if anybody wants to reach out to me directly, I'm Mark with a K at liquidspace.com.
Excellent. Mark, thank you for your time and for the intriguing conversation today.
And Jamie, thank you for your time. It's an exciting future before us.
Until next time.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.